Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Canadian jazz bassist, performer, and composer Alex Fournier. He talked about his new 2022 CD, his trio second album, and that's Trio with Two Eyes, Six-ish Plateaus. He is currently based in Toronto, and he presents multiple groups, series, and initiatives. Among his projects is his main vehicle, Trio, which features episodic compositions that focus on the interplay and mutual influence shared between written music and free collective improvisation, creating the effect of a living score. It's great music. He gets into his whole story, COVID life, and the future. Enjoy.
How have you been doing over this COVID period? You know, now things are opening up. You got a new album out, but how did you kind of maintain and survive as an artist over that time?
It is a little mystifying in some ways, just because I remember being pretty blown away by the gear shift that we all had to deal with. It was a lot to process originally. What I counted myself kind of lucky was I wasn't, being in Canada, we ended up having a little bit of support for a short while we were kind of figuring things out and everything, which was, pretty helpful. And, I wasn't exactly too worried about, financial situations at the time. So, I had some leeway with what I was doing. And so I just basically said that I have a list of projects that I need to tackle. Just in terms of my own playing, my own studying, everything like that. And I just started tackling them in order. And I think 6 months down the line, we started figuring out that playing gigs outdoors was actually viable. A lot of programs in my city started kind of opening up to, make that, way more accessible for people with just, patio music, everything like that. And from there, we just kind of spun up, having more and more of that, more and more opportunities that kind of took advantage of just being in the open air. And I kept myself occupied with projects, little bit of writing and everything like that. I managed to get this album together more or less, by the end of 2020, I knew I was going to be able to do it. Yeah, everyone just kind of had a good game plan at that point in time with had to deal with studio stuff. So I don't know. I think I just managed to find enough stuff to keep me busy. That's probably just like a fraction of it. But I'll keep it to the musical stuff for the sake of discussion here.
For sure. So you're saying you had this album done for a while. So were you waiting for a more ideal time to release it?
No, actually, we recorded it at the end of the summer of 2021, and I just kind of knew the project was going to be viable by the end of 2020. And I mean, certainly, pandemic stuff kind of weighed on what that timeline would have been. There definitely were a lot of things where we had to kind of schedule for warmer weather, had to schedule for, when everyone was going to be in the country at the same time, stuff like that. Yeah, this was pretty much purely a pandemic project. I think I had some of the writing complete before, but even the lineup of the band changed in the meantime. So, it was definitely an effort over the course of the first half of 2021, getting it all together.
So talk to me about how you put this album together. How did all of it artistically, from that standpoint, come together for the final product?
I mean, much like the music itself, the album kind of has an element of collage work to it. A few of the songs were kind of older pieces that kind of got, gussied up, revived, like had extra parts kind of considered, and essentially just kind of modernizing it for the point that the band's at. Some of them were pieces that I had kind of written in the flash for this group that would have happened like right at the end of 2019, just because we were kind of touring around for efforts for our first album. And, when you have to fill out two sets, even when you're writing music and stuff like that, you're probably going to need at least, like, writing long music, you're probably going to need at least, like, four pieces or something. So, you know, there were two pieces that kind of got written during the pandemic. One of them is not included on the album. It's kind of its own miniature suite. It was recorded in the same session. I'm going to be releasing it as an EP next year. That one's called Magnetic Dreaming, and it's a long one. And then there was another one. The title track actually was written kind of in just like two flashes of inspiration. So the first half was, I got an idea for that bass vamp, just pretty much immediately. Went and figured out what I was doing with playing it. And then I just kind of rearranged the bass vamp into the melody and stuff like that. And then, like, 6 months later, I didn't have an ending for this thing. I took a look at this other vamp that I wrote on the same day and said, like, oh, they got a similar metric thing going on. So why don't I just figure out how to tie them together in that case? And so, yeah, I think that one's kind of a pure effort over there. Yeah, I mean, the rest of it was just recording it and seeing how they sat together on the album at that point in time. Usually you can find some sort of thread between them, but yeah, I'm pretty happy with the progression of the tracks on this one.
What about the listener? What are you hoping those that buy or download this get from what you've put together?
I hope that it feels like an adventure to them in some sense. Like, we have we have the first track, An Intrepid Toad, which, you know, it's a nice soft entry into because, you know, it kind of escalates in intensity for a while and then, you know, drops off to something a lot more gentle that kind of just cruises along in a cool way and then goes out with a bang. And so, I mean, you know, I was fortunate that the formatting worked that way. And, you know, I know that I, when I was listening to this, just, you know, going over mixes and masters and stuff, it felt like it really had almost kind of a narrative progression to it. You know, it's music, like there's no specific meaning to the language there and stuff. So it's an affective narrative, but, you know, I hope that kind of reaches people on that level and brings them along in a way that they can kind of experience their own kind of progression that kind of takes them through all these, you know, various beats of intensity and, you know, sereneness as well.
So how did this whole journey for jazz specifically begin for you? How did you, as I kind of think, the jaws of jazz get in you, and how did that take off from here?
I started out as like an electric bass player just ahead of high school, who was interested mainly in pop punk bands at the time. I eventually had a friend kind of get me into, like, you know, classic thrash metal and stuff like that, and it's an interesting progression. Learning that Metallica had like a virtuoso bassist who, you know, could play just as well as the guitar players was really compelling to me. And then in my subscription of Guitar World, one day someone wrote a tab out for Mahavishnu Orchestra's Birds of Fire. So I usually kind of credit that moment in conjunction with having a high school jazz band, which is like, oh, cool, I can get a credit for just playing electric bass for an hour a day. That sounds great. So it was kind of slow exposure with that type of stuff and me just kind of finding a thread that connected what I was already doing with what I could be doing. Yeah, I remember going out for one of those all-star youth big bands or something like that and auditioning on electric. And I think I did well on everything except for my sight reading at the time. And I ended up getting sat down by the director who said, like, look, you're really great and everything, but you don't play double bass. So, you know, it's going to sound really weird you trying to support a big band without, you know, playing that instrument. And so, you know, about 2 weeks later, I end up getting my days mixed up and forgetting to bring my electric bass. And, you know, there's a strings room in the high school. I knew they had a couple of double basses there. So I was just like, oh, I'll show you who could play double bass. yeah, just ended up picking it up from there, and you know, finding a wealth of things to explore with it. Yeah, I'd say that's kind of what got me started proper.
So, who were some influences, or I guess more accurately, what was the first live jazz show you saw that really blew you away?
This is a tricky one because I mainly feel like I got a lot of my influence from recordings earlier on. I mean, I really prioritized live sets at the time, which, I mean, I guess is kind of meeting halfway there. Well, for a show, there was a while where when I was doing my undergrad, we had the sax player Tim Reese on faculty for exactly the 4 years that I was there, which was really cool to, you know, have someone of that caliber, you know, flying up every week. For us, and I think it was definitely one of his shows. It might have been the time that he actually managed to have John Patitucci come up as a guest player. I mean, it was Tim, John, and then we had a student playing with them, who interestingly enough was a drummer named Max Roach. And he was like an unbelievable drummer. And yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of the first time that I saw a set of music that almost like went beyond my comprehension in real time. Like I almost couldn't follow certain beats, like what they were doing was so beyond everything. But you know, at the same time, I'm watching one of my classmates play with them, and like that kind of, I feel like that kind of opened up, you know, a lot of thoughts of just like, you know, hey, I mean, if he can do it and we're in the same, you know, program here, then I've got the potential to do it as well. So it had a lot of personal meaning there, and, you know, I still kind of, you know, have like snippets of those instances, like, of what they were playing, and it's just like, oh my God, how were they coming up with that stuff on the spot? Jeez. So, I mean, I'd say that that's the first time that I really kind of, you know, got blown away.
So what is it that you like the best about being a professional musician? I mean, this is something you wake up every day, you get to create music. What is it that you like the best about the process?
You know, there's a lot of difficulty that you deal with in terms of, you know, the fact that you really have to be consolidated these days in terms of everything that you have to do. You know, professionalism means you record, you know, understanding every part of your industry and being able to do them, all of them, for yourself in varying degrees, which, you know, isn't always the funnest thing. But I mean, I think I'll kind of defer to a quote from Michael Formanek at one point in time. It's like, I hate everything about getting there, but when I get there, it's all right. And I think that that's kind of, you know, the thing that you feel like you live for with this is that, you know, when you actually get to the gig, when you actually get to do what it is that you enjoy doing, it's kind of like the world just goes away for a little bit. And, you know, all you really have is that stance you've assumed, and, you know, the people that you're playing with as well, and, you know, the chance to create something out of that stance. You know, it's almost kind of like you're not dealing with time for a little while, and then you get off the bandstand and find out 55 minutes has gone by. So, yeah, I'd say that's kind of what keeps me going with it.
That sounds pretty ideal for sure. What about a dream show? Let's say you get into a time machine. You can go back in time. What show would you go to? Who would you see?
Probably Miles Davis's Second Quintet. That band, like, I still revisit. You know, Miles Wayne, Herbie, Ron, Tony. Like, there was just such, like, a bustling energy that those guys had together that there's so many connections to be made in terms of that music. I mean, you know, there's someone in the band, who I think they have a quote that goes something like, I wish people would stop, like, you know, obsessing over that group. We were just lost the entire time. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, well, I don't know. You guys were kind of creating out of that, you know, out of the urgency of saying, like, okay, we're lost. What are we going to do with that now? And having something like that raw committed to recording is I think it's, you know, almost like a blessing to the rest of the jazz world. And that, you know, you have a model for something that, you know, vital, that fresh, you know, they're reinventing song forms as they're playing it sometimes. So, yeah, I think seeing that live would have been a really remarkable, really remarkable experience.
That has to be one of the top answers, too. It always comes back to that specific Miles incarnation. You know, so speaking of live shows, and now that we're getting back to it, what do you hope we all realize about the power of live music as we get back to it more and more?
This is something I've been thinking a lot about music in general, is that, you know, we talk about music as being linguistic or like a language. And it is and it isn't. I mean, like, we have a very confined view of language in that we say words, we pronounce these sounds, and, you know, we have gestures, facial expressions, accents, tones, all these things that kind of go into the communication of something that we feel is specific. But with music, I mean, there's none of that, you know, specificity. In the sense that, you know, if I play an A, you're not going to glean a meaning from A unless it's your own meaning. But when you string these things together, it becomes something that creates a very common experience, in that most people will have an interpretation that kind of falls within, you know, the range of each other's thoughts. And that's pretty cool. Like, the idea that you have something that is kind of operating with narrative structure, and yet everyone's creating their own narrative within its, I guess, kind of, you know, within its space that it's creating for you. And so in some respects, music, if not all art, is the language of what cannot be said in our language, in our spoken languages. And so I think that we really need that as a compliment. You know, we get hung up on words so much, but we don't really think about what happens in, you know, a gesture or a passage or a phrase or, you know, an entire piece of music. You know, it's just the same as we don't really, you know, we squander our time just trying to describe what's in poetry or just trying to describe what's in, you know, a painting and stuff. And that's all well and good and stuff. But, you know, sometimes just that experience of being there and, you know, basking in it and realize, and, you know, having the chance to make your own connections and your own rearrangements on that, you know, you're bringing something back from a world that can't really be described. It just has to be enacted and it has to be felt. That's a big thing that I enjoy about, you know, practicing art. Yeah, I hope that's an experience everyone can kind of have.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. What is your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Oh, boy. question that one goes over, you know, all the time. I mean, this is interesting. Like, one of the things that I got into over the pandemic was just reading philosophy, because I had time for it right now. And I'm participating in a whole group that's going over Baruch Spinoza's The Ethics right now. The whole book is kind of almost understanding that question in the context of someone not being divided from nature, or not seeing themselves as a separate part and nature as a thing that they observe. And so I don't know if I could actually really answer that. All I really know is that there is this kind of process of discovery of what is irreducible or essential about yourself. Like what can we say about you that we cannot go past or break down to anything further? And once you actually fully understand that, you know, how will you live your life in accordance with that ethic? Yeah, I mean, probably a wacky thing to bring up in an interview here, but I mean, that's still kind of an ongoing process I'm thinking about. Like, you know, what can be said about me that goes beyond like a surface description? You know, am I able to know that about myself just yet? So I don't know. Perhaps I'm just going to say I'm a musician so far, and I'm going to kind of let the rest be a lived experience rather than something that I will struggle to describe for quite a while.
I totally get it. That's a great answer. Alex, thank you for taking time out today. Good luck with the album and the return to the stage. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the interview, Joe. It was a pleasure getting to talk to you, and hope to get to do it again soon.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Toronto, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Alex for his time, energy, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino in the iTunes Store. Visit Neon Jazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. And at JoeDimino.com, you can kick in via Patreon or PayPal. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.